You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week in episode 318, Bieber's out, Adele is out, but fear not, we have dead musicians touring. What is happening to life on the road? When cricket comes before the birth of your own children, and the Diana tapes on Channel 4. Will we all condemn it and then secretly watch it with all the blinds drawn? It's all coming up after Midfield General featuring Linda Lewis and Reach Out.
You know, I love that record so much. It's big regrets of my life. I often regret not going to major gatherings, which probably would have scared the bewotsits out of me had I actually gone. I regret not having gone to the anti-Iraq march, the big one that took place in London. And I very much regret not having attempted to have got tickets to Fatboy Slim's Bonanza Beach concert, where everybody got squashed and it was enormous. They released a soundtrack album, the Big Beach Boutique, and it has this track on it at the beginning. Midfield General is the chap that's done the track, but of course the vocal is Linda Lewis. Midfield General is one of the Skint Records people. I believe his actual name is Damien Harris, but he was involved in running the Skint label with Fatboy Slim for many years. And I'd never heard of Linda Lewis until this record. And after that, I bought everything that she'd done, basically. I have all kinds of Linda Lewis records because I think that it's a wonderful use of a kind of a vocal. over some quite kind of funky sort of dancey type thing. It's a great record, and I'm an enormous fan of it and the album it comes from.
I love Linda Lewis. She's been around forever. She's still only 66. I checked that this morning.
I thought, quite believe that.
Yeah, I know.
Hello.
Well, when you think, she's only 66, but she was in the Hard Day's Night movie as a teenager.
She
was on the bill at the very first Glastonbury Festival. She sang on Bowie's Aladdin Sane album. She's featured in the National Portrait Gallery. She's got a vocal range of 5 octaves. I mean, it's quite a career, isn't it? I mean,
she is amazing. And also, her version of the Sheep song, yeah. I'm sorry, Cher, I am usually a fan, but it really does knock Cher into an interestingly shaped hat, doesn't it, really? I have it on an old Ronco compilation that I found in the basement of a St. Michael's Hospice shop for 20p about 7 years ago. And it has been the best value record that I've ever bought, frankly. I think it currently averages at 0.01 pence a play.
Now, look here. Welcome to the podcast from the Parish Council. It's episode 318. I'm Terence Stackham. And, well, only a matter of time before she's featured in the National Portrait Gallery. It's Juliette Harris.
Chamber of Horrors, I think you'll find. Hello.
Not at all. Jules, in the last couple of weeks, a number of tours have been cancelled, or at least dates pulled because the performers couldn't follow the maxim of the show must go on. Adele had to pull 2 dates at Wembley Stadium recently. Justin Bieber announced last week that he has cancelled the remaining 15 dates of his world tour
What an enormous loss that is.
Very much so. Unforeseen circumstances, that old familiar story.
Indeed, yes. If only pop stars employed more psychics, then this wouldn't happen.
Well, it's increasingly a multi-million pound industry involving hundreds of people working on the logistics of getting these performers with their sets, their light shows. Of course, their entourage, the musicians, caterers, roadies, managers, all around the world so that everything is set up for the audience to cough up, as we know to our own cost, increasingly huge sums to attend these shows. Now, it used to be that a performer dying rather brought a halt to proceedings, and I speak...
Well, you'd think, wouldn't it? As a friend of mine said at school, it's a bit difficult to have the Jimi... He was asked by somebody why the Jimi Hendrix experience had split up, to which he replied, it is rather difficult to have the Jimi Hendrix experience if you were somewhat lacking Jimi Hendrix.
Well, I speak as someone who had tickets for Michael Jackson at the O2, only for him to rain on my parade by rather inconveniently dying a few weeks...
Did he not know it's all about you, Terence? Well, he didn't get the memo.
It was very disappointing behaviour on his part, I thought, dying a few weeks before the gig. But this, this is no longer an obstacle. This week it's been announced that the singer... With Rainbow and Once of Black Sabbath, Ronnie James Dio is to tour this autumn. Well, we might see it as somewhat awkward because Ronnie James Dio died in May 2010.
They're going to need at least 6 men to carry that coffin about, aren't they? That's logistics in itself.
It hasn't stopped his widow Wendy at all. Dio Returns is the name of the tour, in which a hologram of Dio will perform with a live band. Now, it's certainly innovative, but to be fair, something similar was tried with Reasonable Express with Elvis big screen.
The Elvis stuff,
yeah. Yeah, it wasn't a hologram, it was a big screen. In fact, that's touring again this autumn. Elvis on a big screen with a symphony orchestra playing along with him. But a hologram is something new altogether. Would it excite you to go and see dead people as holograms? Perhaps the Beatles on tour with Lennon and Harrison back on stage, Hendrix, as you say, Bowie, and indeed, on this tour this autumn, will you be buying tickets for Ronnie James Dio?
I will not.
It
just seems a bit bizarre, doesn't it, really? I suppose we could draw parallels here with regular podcast listeners or occasional podcast listeners may remember that last year, as part of my birthday treat, I went to see Brian Wilson do Pet Sounds.
Yes. Rain, I remember.
Yes, in the pelting rain in Preston Park in Brighton. We paid enormous amounts of money, about £60 each, for tickets to an all-day festival, which we only arrived at in time to see Brian Wilson. Yeah. because we have been doing various things during the day, and it was foul weather that day. I rang my t-shirt out in the back of the car, if I remember correctly. But anyway, that such things are mere details. And I remember us talking at the time, I think, about how whether or not ethically it was correct to go and see Brian Wilson, you know, whether or not he was actually sort of there, so to speak, whether it is right to go and see someone that is struggling, that sort of thing. And actually, I thought he was great and he was in good voice. But I saw some of our podcasters is talking about this on Facebook recently, about how someone said he could vary within an evening, that they said that the first half of the evening he was fantastic, the second half of the Pet Sounds evening he sang one or two notes a song, and then he came back at the end and did something note perfectly. So I suppose, really, I guess, rather than saying, because the link you sent me to the Adele album, vocal coach slams Adele for her slapdash attitude to looking after her voice. Yeah, okay then, fair enough if you want to have a pop. But having said that, it's not like she's touring, you know, the cockpit. She is doing enormous arenas night after night, and sometimes people get ill and things go wrong, and that's just life, I think. In a way, I admire people like Adele for not wanting to give their audience a second-rate experience. And actually, I think it is the right thing to do, to cancel beforehand rather than to turn up, do four songs and then go off. Because it almost, as Liam Gallagher did in the States this week, I think. He was playing at a Lollapalooza, the festival. He came on, sang four songs, walked off halfway through a song, which the band, to be fair to them, duly finished. And then they all got up and walked off. And later on, he claimed it's because he had a bad gig the day before and had damaged his voice. But he was not particularly good from the crowd. And in a way, I feel like saying, well, it's much better. Although people, we as British people, it's, you know, one struggles on, doesn't one, you know. But in a way, I'd much rather Adele cancelled her gig, that we didn't have to watch Ronnie James Dio because he is dead. And to be fair, that earns you some time off, in my view. I would much rather that we did that then, you know, it's the cricket principle, isn't it? If you see a certain number of overs, you get charged for the whole thing. And I have no desire to pay £100 to go and see 25 minutes of Adele with half a voice and then go, oh, terribly sorry, she can't continue. I think it's the right thing to do. And to go back to the Brian Wilson point, I felt comfortable with it. I felt that it was a good gig. I didn't feel he was doing anything he didn't want to, but there is some question marks over whether he is being forced to do things that he doesn't want to, and to what extent one colludes in that. Also, speaking of people that I do not want to pay and go and see, I think Paul McCartney was brilliant in his day, and so was Ray Davies. They were absolutely fantastic. They'll have their mark forever. Having said this, you know, I don't want to go and see them struggle to sing. Why should I pay £65 to see Paul McCartney struggle to hit the high notes and Live and Let Die? I think it's a rip-off.
He has adapted his voice. I mean, to take account of the passing years, and he can't hit those high notes. But the thing is, what can never be taken away from this, I really do understand why you would say that, but if ever you see footage, any documentary, anything of a McCartney gig, even the ones this year, he's on tour this very moment, is one-on-one tour, he's in the States.
And I'm not anti-Paul McCartney.
And you look at the audience, you see people with rapture on their faces, people crying with the emotion of it all generations, and it's because of what he brings still to an audience in that way, rather than hitting every note as he might have done in 1964.
I take your point. But having said that, Paul McCartney, maybe this is a how good are you actually type thing, because Paul McCartney, and we're probably going to get letter bombs for this, but I do feel that Paul McCartney is a different class to Ronnie James Dio. I'm sorry, but I do. And in a way, I quite dig the Elvis thing. And the thing about the hologram and the symphony, the screen and the symphony orchestra, that's a different thing. You're not pretend. I think this is the difference. If you're using a hologram of someone, you are to some extent trying to pretend that they are still there. And if you've got Elvis on a big screen, we know he's not there because it's on a screen, isn't it? It's on a large screen. You've got a symphony orchestra. So it's doing something different. It's not like you've got a band with a hologram fronting it. I have less of a problem with the Elvis stuff than I do the Ronnie James Dio stuff, I must admit. And also, yes, I can understand that Paul McCartney has touched a lot of people very deeply, and I do feel that the scale of that might be wider than for some other artists.
I think it's such an enormous pressure on these huge stars like Bieber and Adele. They have no bandmates to help take the pressure. And it takes incredible strength of character and iron determination to commit to a world tour of dozens of dates, knowing that the success or otherwise of that tour depends entirely on you and you alone and your ability to be, of course, 100% ready to perform at your peak at, let's say, 8 p.m. at dozens and dozens of different venues all around the world. And it's almost an unimaginable pressure. And I think it's no wonder that some younger performers find it hard to complete these tours.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do. And I think this feeds back to the debate that we seem to have periodically on this podcast about the closing of small music venues. Why should we care? That sort of thing. And the preponderance of pop programs. And I think it's all part of the same problem, which is that people don't cut their teeth on the club circuit anymore. And, you know, when we one of my favorite ever articles in Word magazine, of which I was an enormous fan and still am. And I hadn't expected it to be, because I wasn't a particularly big fan of this, although I did rate him. But there was a really interesting article on Elton John and a long interview that went over several pages, and it talked about his past, you know, as a 14-15 year old playing in the clubs. You learnt the book, you know, you did the songs.
Absolutely.
and in a way I feel that, you know, if you've been doing that something week in, week out, you get better at it, and you build up an endurance to it. You know, I'm considering taking up football again, and I was never even that good in the first place. And if I end up playing football, I know that the first 6 weeks I'm going to be appalling. I'm going to be, you know, being dumped on my ass by 16-year-olds all over the shop, frankly. It's going to be awful. I'm not old enough for the veterans, Terence. You have to be 35 for the veterans. So I am going to be pushed over by every 19-year-old in the Greater Sussex area. But having said that, after 8 weeks I won't be as bad, and I won't collapse after 20 minutes, because I'll know, my body will know what endurance levels I need to do. And actually, people forget singing is a physical activity. It's not like, you know, you just rock up and bang a few out. You know, if you're touring and operating to the level of people like Adele do, who have magnificent voices, then you know, then that's an enormously high standard to have to try and keep up every week. And it's inevitable that sometimes you might not be able to do that, but it's particularly inevitable if you haven't, I mean, to be fair, Adele didn't come up through a pop program. She came up, you know, she came up as an emerging artist. But I still think that the club circuit would toughen a lot of people up, really. Not that I'm criticizing Adele, I think she did the right thing, but it's interesting that the live music arena, right, and this is key, I think, these huge stadium tours, I mean, Adele seems to have gone from toilet venues to stadium tours, as far as I can see. There wasn't a kind of a mid sort of touring period. And I think that you know, it's like you're going from 10 miles an hour to 60 miles an hour, really. And I think the lack of a kind of a mid-paced, the fact that people, the live arena is a big earner now, but people are famous elsewhere and then they sing live, don't they? They become famous on TV and then they sing live, and inevitably it always goes wrong. Look at that woman that won How Do You Solve a Problem Like Maria on TV. I can't remember the woman's name.
God, McManus. Michelle McManus. No.
This is a lady that won the Sound and Music thing. Her name was Connie, I think.
Connie, yes, I remember.
She was fantastic. She was clearly the one. She had that thing about her that made her the one. And she was, then the prize was she got to sing on stage in the West End and really struggled to do six shows a week. Martin McCutcheon had a similar experience with My Fair Lady, because it is really, really, really hard. And that's where I think sometimes people in the live arena, people like Adele and Justin Bieber, come unstuck, because they haven't necessarily, although they may have, Adele may, you know, she was on XL, so she may have done smaller gigs, but they haven't made their names by being touring acts. They haven't made their names by, you know, kind of, you know, doing you know, the toilet circuit, and then you do venues of about, you do theatre venues, and then you might, you know, do some larger venues and some outdoor venues, and then you start thinking about arenas.
Connie Fisher, to save anyone tweeting.
Thank you. Although if you've already tweeted already without realising it, what?
Yeah, thanks for your interest. Yes. Just a quick point there. I mean, I'm going to sound once again like somebody from the dinosaur prehistoric ages, but
Tedsaurus, I think, is what they call you.
I've been saying for a good 20 years about Liam Gallagher, and this is going to apply to a degree to a lot of younger singers as well. I said from the word go that Liam Gallagher was one day going to pay for the way he sings, because he doesn't.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
He sings from the throat.
Oh, it's so nasal, isn't it?
He doesn't sing from his diaphragm. So he's always, his whole career, especially when on tour, when it's, as you say, night after night, you said a bad gig the night before, it doesn't have time to recover, because if you wreck your throat singing, it takes days, if not weeks, for it to recover. But if you sing from your diaphragm, if you've been trained properly, and what bewilders me is that many of these young singers today go to, I better not say the names of the schools in case we get sued, but the, you know, insert name of famous
stage
schools here, they still don't teach them, even though they're there for 3 years at $9,000 a year tuition fees, they don't teach them to sing properly in the traditional way, like opera singers do, and the really big singers of the world of the past. That's how they sustain their careers and sustain tours, by singing properly in a trained way. Otherwise, you end up in the Liam Gallagher.
Absolutely, well. And interestingly, as I am our regular PJ Harvey correspondent, she found a similar thing when she started off as a young singer. Don't forget that she made Dry when she was 20, her debut album, and so she, of course, their first ever gig was in a bowling alley, and she, of course, was playing in a noisy trio at the time, and so she found herself kind of shouting to be heard in small, well, in the days of the thriving toilet circuit, and she said that about 2 or 3 years in, she was starting to get really ill. She wasn't looking after herself, and she actually, to try and help save her voice, went to have singing lessons with an opera singer that lived in her village, I think, in her parents' village. Yeah. And not only did it help save her voice, it completely changed her style of singing. And I think the first album, if I'm correct in this, the first album she made after doing this was To Bring You My Love, which has got To Bring You My Love on it, which is very operatic in its style of singing. So actually, it's completely, you know, it just goes to show that if you're willing to kind of swallow it a bit and not want to, you know, PJ Harvey, the indie darling, was willing to have the foresight to go and see an opera singer and to push yourself out of your comfort zone, it can pay dividends, and it doesn't mean you have to do opera necessarily.
If your partner was going into labour, would you?
there are a lot of ifs in this question for me, Terence, but do go on.
If your partner was going into labour, would you head for the maternity ward or to a cricket match? That's next after Empire of the Sun.
We can remember swimming in December, heading for the city lights, 975. We sharing each other, nearer than father, scent of the lemon drips from your eyes. Tonight, remember.
A really bright, summery single to cheer up even the greyest day. Number 14 in the UK in the summer of 2009, Empire of the Sun and We Are the People.
They are a nice band. I know that Luke Jackson has, inclined to be a bit here and there, shall we say. But I think they're a really interesting proposition.
They are. And I would never really sit down and listen to an album, but I take the odd track and the singles and the more well-known songs. And great. And of course, you know, such different voices, but it works terribly well. And I notice at the moment they're working. Keeps popping up in commercials all over the place.
It's Luke Steele. I'd call him Luke Jackson. He's actually called Luke Steele of alternative rock act The Sleepy Jackson, so I'm sorry to have kind of mangled that.
Now, we've discussed before the odd way people behave these days at public events.
Well, it's in fact, the odd way that we ourselves behave at public events. It seems to be a sort of staple of this beer house, doesn't it, really?
Now you mention it, yes.
I didn't exempt myself from that, can I just say, Terence?
No.
In case someone tweets in and thinks I'm picking on you again.
Yes, indeed. Now, I've mentioned how I find it increasingly bizarre that people will spend a small fortune getting into a gig only to spend the time paying as little attention as possible to what's happening on the stage.
And that's treating us all to a view of the back of their iPad.
Well, indeed, I've mentioned that. And I haven't mentioned this before, I don't think. I went to see Scritti Politti about 2 years ago in a small venue in London. And I actually had to move because we were surrounded by people during the gig while they were playing, socialising, chatting, braying with laughter, to the extent that I Green's vocals were inaudible. I think I had mentioned before, I remember friends of mine getting into trouble at a Bruce Springsteen gig in Hyde Park, where they got into an argument with people because these people were just sort of like, again, just having a kind of party and laughing and, you know, telling each other humorous anecdotes while Bruce Springsteen was trying to play Born to Run.
But quite, yes.
Also, a year or two ago, I was bewildered by people at the O2 in Greenwich, a once in a lifetime opportunity to see Barbara Streisand, and for the whole gig, I've said before, hundreds of people were streaming up and down the stairs to go to the food and drink concessions and returning with cardboard trays loaded with lager and hot dogs.
Absolutely. I mean, who did I go and see? Iron Maiden, I think, once at the O2, and someone walked past us what appeared to be an entire roast dinner about sort of 20 minutes in.
It's amazing. And we've also discussed the peculiar practice of leaving football matches 10 minutes before the end, you know, with the potential consequence of missing a hat full of goals and incidents. Well, I've got a new chapter to write on this theme. On Monday, a lovely day in London, I was at the Oval this week for the final day of the Test match, England against South Africa. Any result was possible, but England were on top, aiming to weed out the remaining half dozen or so South African batsmen. I noticed quite soon into the day that there was this young fellow just alongside from us. He seemed to be quite agitated, and he kept looking at his phone, and I thought, well, maybe he's waiting for a text or something, maybe some important business deal or something.
Yes, absolutely.
Then we heard him. It was a drinks break at about 12. During a drinks break, he was making this whispered phone call to his mum, explaining that although his partner had been admitted to the maternity ward the evening before, he hadn't wanted to give up his ticket and miss the test match. So he was justifying being at the Oval while it was clear his mother, from his reaction, his mother was giving him a real ear bashing on the phone.
Good for her, frankly. We are all that woman.
A couple in front of him were mildly teasing him about this, and he said that the maternity ward had promised to text him. He was on his own, to text him if the birth looked imminent. And then at about 12:30, his phone buzzed, and he shot down the stairs, and he was out of sight in seconds. I've never seen anyone move so fast at a cricket match. 1 minute later, 12:31, he was back, cheerily telling everyone, "It's okay, it was a false alarm." But the marvellous climax to all of this was that in the middle of the afternoon,
You are Larry David, Terrence. You do realise.
Moeen Ali, middle of the afternoon, sun still shining, lovely day. Bowled hat-trick to finish off the test match. The last three batsmen...
What an effing ledge.
fantastic. Won the Test match for England. Marvellous. The trouble is, our expectant father finally got the call to leave about 5 minutes before this, and he dashed off and missed the denouement to the game. So, you know, although he got in a few hours of watching the cricket, he missed the climax of the game. He also had to put up with his mum really telling him off over the phone, and basically runner around him at the Oval going, you know, go to the hospital.
That man lost out in everything, and it just goes to show, if you don't try and prioritise and you try and do everything at once, you get nothing done.
And you've come across some eccentric souls at your own sojourns to sporting events.
Well, I have, really. I mean, I've come across... I used to go and watch a lot of non-league football, and we used to have people that insisted on bringing their own chairs when there were sort of... I mean, a bit, this perhaps isn't as old as you'd think, because we used to sit in this stand at Hastings, which had been built in the 1920s. I remember once a ball... The roof was... there were no... The seating, it was concrete steps, and there was some wooden... a wooden kind of pallet top to the top of it. I remember you were only allowed to sit in a plastic bucket seat if you were a season ticket holder. And I remember sitting on one of these things next to my dad once, and I did not realise I'd sat on chewing gum until Hastings scored a goal, and I jumped up to celebrate and found that, unfortunately, I was somewhat impeded in doing that. But despite the fact, you know, so they weren't terribly comfortable, but we did have some people once who brilliantly brought their own picnic chairs and then found enough space at the bottom of the concrete steps to then pointedly set them out and sit in them. And they were told to move by stewards and didn't, and nothing ever happened. And equally, I've been seeing non-league football before where people have sat down behind me and got their knitting out. I was watching a match once, and I helped my good friend next to me, who was knitting I think she was knitting a jumper. And I occasionally had to, I was of a similar size to the person who was knitting it for. So occasionally, if the ball went out of play, I would stand up and she would kind of hold it. She'd tell me to sort of stretch my arms out, and we'd hold it across my chest, and then the ball would go back into play and she'd carry on knitting again. I think it was her as well that offered. I took her to football once, and we were in Eastbourne, I think, watching the Lewis women's team play an away match. And she said, "Oh, would you like some brownies?" And got out this admirably battered looking tin. I mean, it looked a bit like it would have had a gas mask in it once upon a time, and took the top off, and there were these lovely still warm chocolate brownies it was you know, very sedate as I watched one of the Eastbourne defenders have her asthma attack and be taken away. It was quite nice to have a, you know, some chocolatey taste in the mouth whilst this rather large girl was guided to safety by various people, and I sat there smugly having loudly wondered why she should have been playing and was called a body fascist, and then turned out to be right. Anyway, so I do enjoy going to watch matches where I remember reading, I can't remember if it was an interview or a written interview or a TV interview with Harry Enfield's father once. It might have been for This Is Your Life or something similar. And they talked about Harry Enfield used to be taken to watch Brighton as a teenager. And I can't remember the name of the bloke now. It might have been Keith something or other. There was a footballer that was very much at the latter days of his career that was rather sort of overweight and gone to seed. But the crowd would always put immense amounts of pressure for him to be brought on. So what would happen would be Harry Enfield would spend the entire match reading the programme. He would not be interrupted from reading the programme. So everyone would be watching the match. He'd be sat there reading the programme, cover to cover. And then for the last 15 minutes, when this bloke was literally paraded out on the touchline and would warm up and waddle along the touchline, Harry Enfield would enjoy enthusiastically waving and cheering for this man to be brought on. And he often wasn't in the end, it turned out. And then he would go back to reading the programme, and then the match would finish. So I like a chat during football. And watching football with my dad always has large amounts of tension in it, because we have this weird dichotomy. I often see my dad in the presence of my mum, which means 85% of the conversation is taken over by my mum. I ask my dad a question and my mum answers, as lots of couples do, I think, when they reach a certain age, and I mean that fondly, which means that the only time I can ever have a conversation with my dad is when we're watching football, and then he doesn't want to talk because we're watching football. So I could always get it to a certain point with my dad watching football. We watched the England women's match last night, and I did have to have the whole misgendering is violence conversation with him at the beginning, but apart from that, it went fairly well, I felt. So yeah, I am a fan of doing more than one thing at once. I come from a proud lineage of this. My mum much preferred the American remake of The Killing to the actual Killing for no other reason than she watches TV whilst ironing and she can't keep up with the subtitles. So she watches the American remakes of things like The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, not because she's a Philistine, but because she's a busy woman. So I'm a fan of multitasking, but I think going to watch a football match when your partner is in labour is perhaps going a bit beyond that.
I rather hope that when that young man at the Oval got to the maternity ward, it was St Mary's, I think he mentioned, that his wife or partner, you know, said, oh, you know, good of you to turn up.
I hope she gave him hell, although, yeah. To be honest, busy, you know.
She may have been concerned with other issues.
Unbelievable, but never mind. But this is us women, Terence. We can multitask. I could give birth and be cross at the same time.
I just hope that they'll call the child Moeen or
Ali. I think Ali's a great name. Call the kid Ali. Or I don't know. Or Untimely Exit, perhaps.
Yes.
That would have to be double-barreled, but, you know, it would work.
As we record this, Channel 4 are pressing ahead despite protests with their plan to broadcast Diana in her own words. Off-the-record tapes, The Princess of Wales, made in 1993. Is this a case where public interest overrides invasion of privacy? We'll be back with that right after Kevin Mark Trail.
Stand on a bridge overlooking the Thames. Stare at my reflection, it's here I learn my lesson. Stand on a bridge overlooking the Thames. Stare at my reflection, it's here I learn my lesson. Stand on a bridge overlooking the Thames. Stare at my reflection, it's here I learn my lesson. Stand on a bridge overlooking the Thames. Stare at my reflection, here I learn my lesson. Feel the wind against my face. Feel like life is walking past me. I need to focus. I have broken many hearts, but it seems I broke my own in two. In the process, I stand on a bridge overlooking the Thames. I stare at my reflection. It's here I learn my lesson. A bridge overlooking the Thames. Stare at my reflection. It's here I learn my lesson. I hope the rain stops chasing me, surrounded by the autumn leaves. I need to focus. I'm declaring love and peace, and I hope it sets my spirit free. In the process, I stand on a bridge overlooking the Thames. I stare at my reflection. It's here I learn my lesson. I stand on a bridge overlooking the Thames. I stare at my reflection. It's here I learn my lesson. We'll try not to live my life in the shadows.
From 2005 and his album Just Living, that was a single from the album, Kevin Mark Trail and D Thames. Now, it's quite easy, I think, particularly when one's views are left-leaning, to become quite outraged at the decisions made by newspapers, television, other media outlets, when it comes to deciding whether or not to publish contentious material. The old Iron Duke, the Duke of Wellington, he's often quoted in such situations. "Publish and be damned," he is said to have responded when one of his mistresses, Harriet Wilson, was considering publishing her memoirs.
I think that's a great approach, by the way. Big up to that man.
Indeed, yes, yes. You know, devil take the high road, yes.
Can I celebrity name drop at this point? I don't have the propensity to do this that you do because I haven't lived your life.
No.
But I am, and I was at the time and still am to some extent, friendly with a nice singer called Claire Hamill, who people might remember. She was on Ireland in the late 60s, early 70s. Her band for her first album, which I think was called Last House Standing, or One House Standing, included John Martin. And they had, I think I can say this now, I think she's talked about this previously, they had an affair for some years, I think, or at least there were relations between the two of them. And I think this was fairly widely known. And she was writing a book a few years ago when John Martin was still alive, and said, One House Left Standing, by the way, is that first album. She said to John Martin, you know, what are you happy with me writing? What aren't you happy with me writing? What does Beverly think? And he just said, in true John Martin style, well, you just write what you want. And that was John Martin's full thoughts on the matter. So she did, I believe. I'm always a fan of, you know, write what you want. The fact of the matter is, if someone thinks it and they have a view, as long as it's not obviously libelous, then, you know, go on, is my view.
Well, Channel 4 and Channel 5 here in the UK are usually the go-to television channels for tabloid-style revelations.
Yes, unfortunately. I regret to say that about Channel 4, because at least Channel 5 started off on that basis with Dawn Airy and the Notorious 3Fs, whereas Channel 4... once had delusions of being something better, I think.
Yeah, they clothed them in a sort of suit of respectability by promoting them as documentaries. This weekend, Channel 4 is planning, despite complaints, as I said earlier, to run a documentary in which perhaps rather indiscreet recordings Diana Princess of Wales made with a voice coach in 1993 are to be aired. And it appears they will reveal very intimate revelations of her life at the time and reflections, none too kind, it seems, on her married life with Prince Charles. Jules, is all this fair game in the name of entertainment, or, you know, should this programme be pulled from the schedules?
Well, I suppose my main concern is not so much, it's never about the people who are dead, because they are, unless they're being, you know, resurrected as
a hologram, yeah,
they are very much dead. So it doesn't affect them, you know, they've gone. But I think it's always about the people that are left behind. I think it's very interesting that I know that that her sons, William and Harry, are now, or they're, you know, Prince Harry's my age roughly, and Prince William's a couple of years older, so a year or two older. So, you know, they're not even young men anymore, they're adults, aren't they? But having said that, Prince Harry, and I think I'm not particularly a royalist, although having said that, I do admire the young royals, because they are very open and they're trying to do it in a different way, and I think that's to be admired. And they particularly seem to have taken up the cause of mental health, which I think is admirable. I think it's terrific. And Prince Harry did that excellent podcast with Bryony Gordon of The Telegraph about, you know, his difficulties with coming to terms with his mother's death, and how he'd only very recently kind of started to deal with it, and therapy and all that sort of thing. And I know they are adults now. I know they're not small children anymore. And interesting, I know that Earl Spencer has recently had a rant about the fact that the kids were made to walk behind the coffin, and it was such a harrowing experience, which I think it very much was. But I think that although they are now adults, and therefore one expects to find these things easier to bear than children would, I still think it is disrespectful. I think that it shows a lack of kindness and a lack of forethought that, you know, there are people that are very much affected by this and still are. I'm less bothered about the fact that she's not very nice about Charles, because, you know, let's face it, he is irritating. But having said that, and, you know, we've all slagged off our ex-partners in public, and that's a slightly different thing. But I am concerned for, you know, her children and her kind of younger relatives, you know. And also, I suppose, in a way, maybe it is about her. Maybe it is about the fact that she's dead, because she hasn't given consent for this to be revealed, has she?
No, not at all.
Private Tate, I mean, you said they were indiscreet, and I know that, you know, without speaking ill of the dead, you know, Diana knew how to play the game to a large extent, and will probably admit that herself, to be fair. So you know, she was very media savvy. So who knows? Maybe she had made them with half an eye to or half a mind to using them in the future. Who knows? But I think if you are using something that is controversial, that might hurt somebody's loved ones in their wake, and they haven't, if they haven't left any orders for them to be used, I think that it makes me think, what are your motives? And I struggle to find anything other than publicity and money behind that.
It's almost a spurious argument. I'll tell you why. Because in our digital, you know, internet age, once the genie is out of the bottle, there's no way to cap it. And I only had to, I put two words, Diana tapes, into YouTube for the already aired American version of this documentary
to
pop up.
Yeah.
And there was also a host of variations, the full TV show, as they say, the full set of tapes alone, just the you know, not in a documentary, edited highlights. And, you know, I wish, of course, also with hopeless optimism, that any publisher, TV or print, considers the impact, as you say, on family, loved ones, friends, before printing or screening such as these tapes. But I do understand that my, and I suppose your views, you know, are prehistoric on this. And it all leads to the rather sad and inevitable advice, I think. It's so sad that we should feel that we're at this point now. But one that would have to say now to anybody coming into the public eye, whether they're royalty, politicians, sports stars, celebrities, be careful what you say to anybody. Unguarded words can come back to haunt us decades after we've said them.
Absolutely.
And this is why public figures now work so hard to say nothing of interest in interviews, because of the danger of a career ruined by a handful of misinterpreted or careless
Absolutely.
Words.
Absolutely. And one could argue that we end up with the public figures that we deserve, because the same people that will be complaining about, oh, isn't it dreadful that so-and-so said this, and so-and-so said that, are the same people that will be complaining that people are boring in 10 or 15 years' time. I mean, I agree with you on that. Also, the point that you might think is a really good one about the fact that you can get the tapes in the already published American documentary, it's long been a feature of British libel law and sort of freedom of the press over here, that if something has been already published in another jurisdiction, then press can often take it upon themselves to republish. So, for example, the topless pictures of Kate Middleton were published by the French Hello, I think, and, you know, but without attracting letters and or legal action. Why is it always sodding France that do this? But anyway, so I've always had a bit of a problem with the idea that if it's been published in another jurisdiction, all of a sudden that makes it fair game. I suppose in the internet age, it's more likely that, you know, like you just said, you can go onto the internet and look something up. But yeah, I find, you know, the excuse, oh, well, someone in Morocco published it, so therefore the British public needs to see this. And it's like, can they not just pop on the internet and look up a stream from Morocco? I mean, I think the internet is a counter-argument as well as an argument for that.
Yes, good point. Assuming you're not featured in a tell-all documentary on Channel 4 this week.
There is precious little to tell, my love, I have to say.
Where might we find you in the coming 7 days?
Well, if you happen to be on the seaside, on the Sunshine Coast, if you find yourself in Hastings on the evening of Saturday the 5th of August, I am resurrecting my Sheila's Take a Bow pairing with my nice friend Letty, and we will be at the Dragon Bar in Hastings. It is the Old Town Carnival in Hastings on Saturday evening, which is the, in Hastings Old Town, which is the climax of Old Hastings Week. There have been lots of, well, we'll have to talk about this another time, but there have been lots of people running up hills in very heavy old boots, timed in a competition, and pram races. People make their own prams and race them down a hill. There are lots of fun things. There is a carnival queen. I think there was some sort of mermaid's world record attempt. All sorts of things happen. But anyway, we are inadvertently participating in Old Town Carnival Week by doing our unique brand of drinking too much and shouting whilst playing glam records mostly. So if you want to come and experience that, the Dragon Bar is lovely. Do come and see that. I'll be back with Indie Wonderland next week. The 9th of August, Wednesday 9th of August, Barricade Radio, 8 till 10 p.m, doing indie, alt rock and miscellaneous type things.
Thanks to our marvellous executive producer Rona, and we're going to a debut album from 2011 to play us out, Jules.
We are on a very fine one indeed. And I suppose it's almost inevitable that I would like this, given that she is often compared to PJ Harvey, and her debut album was produced by Rob Ellis of PJ Harvey fame. I'm an enormous fan of her. I think she's absolutely terrific. She's got, and talking about operatic singing earlier on, I think that's why she's compared to PJ Harvey so much, because she has this real, this real sort of, you know, operatic kind of sort of the fluctuations in her voice. But she's sung beautifully at the David Bowie prom tribute a year or two ago. And I'm also very attached to this song. My friend Adrian introduced me to this album and this lady. And also when I was working in Tunbridge Wells, the one man in the building that kept me sane, my nice roommate Graham, was a very big fan of Anna Calvin. So was his daughter. And I bought him her album as a I'm leaving present when I did a Finally Leave. And one of the singles from this, my first ever radio show that I did, Hastings Rock, my women's rock show, I closed it with this because we ran out of room for Laura Marling, so she was the kind of contemporary offering at the end, because I did it chronologically. I love this song. I think it's so powerful and just has a real punch. I think it's terrific. And it also, I don't know why, but it always feels like an ending song for me. It feels like the climax of a musical, so I thought we'd pop it at the end. This is Anna Calvi from her debut album Anna Calvi, and this is Desire.
I wanna go to the sun, pour my life like I'd never done. But it's just the devil in me, the devil that's calling as I come undone. The sky is getting dark at night, darker than the fear that's gonna pull us apart. My beating is the sound of love, the sound of love is beating like a fevered heart. And it's the fire.
You have been listening to a Dacca Media production.
Sorry.